are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide. And let me link with John Feerick, a professor of law at Fordham University Law School, a former dean for 2 decades. And John, you are indeed very welcome.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to participate.
Maybe we'll start with your most recent recognition, and one indeed that John Feerick, I don't think you're going to top this one. You are the recipient of the 2017 American Bar Association, your medalist. It's the highest honor awarded by the American Bar Association, an organization of 400,000 members. That one in particular, I'm sure, will find a special place on your mantelpiece. First of all, congratulations, and maybe you'll tell us about that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. The award came as a total shock. On July 10th, President of the American Bar Association said she would like to meet with me, along with the Dean of Fordham Law School, in connection with the annual meeting of the ABA, which took place in August, and told me that I had been selected for this honor, and I was totally, just overwhelmed by it. And she explained to me that the focus this year of the annual meeting and the choice had to do with lawyers involved in citizenship activities, and identified in a presentation to me the activities that have been really part of my life for the past 50 plus years. And I obviously was very humbled by and overwhelmed by my selection. The presentation was made on August 12th. It was absolutely overwhelming experience. They brought in to the annual meeting of the ABA the flags of all the states, and it was a wonderful ceremony, which is part and parcel of the annual meeting. And the president of the American Bar Association, Linda Klein, made a presentation that was received by my family. I had my children, grandchildren, my wife were present, and their sibling as well. Certainly one of the greatest nights of my life. And I said in my remarks that I hope to continue to serve until I no longer can continue because of my health or otherwise. And just the joy of what I received from my service was far more reward than I ever expected, in terms of this kind of recognition.
John, can you bring us back to your childhood? And first of all, you might tell us a little bit about your immigrant parents from Mayo.
I thank you for asking that question, because I said at the presentation of the medal that I learned from my parents not only my Catholic faith but and about my heritage, but I learned of the importance of being a person of others, as my parents were. They came each from County Mayo alone to the United States. They met here and married in 1935, and I was their firstborn in 1936. My father did all kinds of things. He was a sand hog. He worked in the water tunnels of New York, worked on the waterfront. He worked in Sheffield Milk Company. And then he went away during the war to work on military installations crucial to the war effort, and came back at the end of the war, operated a trolley, and then I drove a bus and retired. And my mother, in all the years, just ran a home, our home, with love and focus on the five of us. And she also was a person that brought over to the home people, Irish people who were alone in America, and she had befriended, and some may have had a family relationship. So we saw a mother and a loving kindness to others, and a father in his life of hard work. You know, just to ask us to make something of ourselves. And they gave us an inheritance, not a material inheritance, but an inheritance of our faith and a commitment to others, basically. We saw that in our parents. And so this award is really about their voices that I expressed in my work and at the time of the presentation.
Now, on the 50th anniversary of the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, as a young lawyer being selected to be on a drafting committee to introduce this 25th Amendment to the Constitution, that was it must have been a great honor as well. Can you bring us back to that?
Yes. When I graduated from law school in 1961, I saw a problem that existed in the Constitution having to do with ambiguities in the presidential succession provision of the Constitution, having to do with the meaning of inability of a president, the status of a vice president in a case of inability, and who goes about declaring a president disabled. And I began to write on that problem while I practiced law in a then small firm. I used my nights and my weekends, my holidays, any time I had off to study the subject of the inability of a president. And it culminated in an article that appeared a month before President Kennedy's assassination. And I had a letter in the New York Times maybe a week before his assassination, a little bit more than a week, urging Congress at a time when we had a young, able, and healthy president to deal with the problem of disability of a president. Little did I realize that a week later, President Kennedy would be assassinated. And because of the study I had done, which appeared in the Fordham Law Review, I was invited to participate in the ABA conference. But I also, the study itself also was prominently mentioned in the New York Times of November 24, 1963, 2 days after the assassination. And that called attention to the work I had done. And I received requests from the media and others to provide some education, you might say, as to the problem of presidential disability. So the experience of being invited to be on the ABA commission and then to testify before Congress and to chair the Young Lawyers Committee of America to promote the passage of the proposal made by the ABA and by Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana was an experience like none other in my life. And you know, like I worked at it with the Senator Bayh and Congressman Seller and Congressman Popp and others, through the ABA, little did I realize that I could be helpful beyond just writing an article by actually participating in the whole process of getting the amendment supported and approved in Congress and ratified by the by the states. It really was, and I was invited by President Johnson to the White House on February, 23, 1967, where he proclaimed that the 25th Amendment was now part of the Constitution. And then I subsequently wrote a book on the 25th Amendment that is used by scholars and educators and others to learn more about the subject.
You know, since you've already identified your own age, at 80, there's no part of you, obviously, that that considers retirement. And you are, if I may say so, you know, one of the most revered law professors. But give us a capsule, if you will, John Feerick, of your association and your affiliation with Fordham, Fordham University, and the law school.
Thank you. I'm a graduate of Fordham College, really the first college graduate, I think, as far as I know, in the history of my family. You know, my ancestors were all farmers in County Mayo. So I graduated Fordham College in 1958 and then went and graduated from Fordham Law School in 1961. And then I got involved in alumni activities at Fordham as I practiced law and was doing my work in the presidential succession area, and eventually became president of the alumni of Fordham Law School and also a trustee of the university. And then in 1982, while I was practicing law, then president of Fordham University was born in Ireland, Father Finley, James Finley from Roscommon, asked me to become dean of the law school. And it was a major change in my life. I thought about it for 3 months. Law practice was going very well for me, and I was able to do what I mentioned. And then I accepted and made a career change and spent 20 years as dean of the school, as you mentioned. And since that time, I've been a full-time professor at the school, teaching courses on ethics and the Constitution right now.
In the area, again, speaking of expertise, you are indeed and have been called on as an alternative dispute resolution, mediation, arbitration, constitutional law, labor and employment law. Tell us and the connection between conflict resolution and your involvement with the peace process in Northern Ireland and your devotion to, again, peace in our land.
Thank you very much. I certainly maybe the best way to answer the question is that back in 1995, I was asked by President Clinton to join him when he made his maiden trip to Belfast. And I remember at that time, Ronald Brown, who was the Secretary of Commerce, I believe, and ultimately, you know, died in a plane crash. We were all encouraged to contribute in different ways to peace in Ireland, and so I came, I got involved at that time, supporting a program at Fordham Law School that brought over citizens of the different traditions to talk to each other and conflict resolution. We put in a proposal that was supported by the White House to help train and talk to people about how we go about in this country resolving conflicts through mediation conflict activities have been part of my life as a lawyer. I had grown up as a practicing lawyer dealing with labor and employment disputes, and then I was drawn on as a dean of the school to come in and serve as a neutral, either as a mediator or as an arbitrator. I did that in the 1980s, and so when the when I went on the piece on Clinton's with Clinton's group, I came back trying to find ways to contribute in our way to reducing the violence in Northern Ireland. And so we sponsored at Fordham Law School alumni trips to Ireland. We started a summer law program that was unique at the time in the year 2000. Now, this is after the peace agreement, 2001, that would bring, we established that program with Queens and Belfast and Dublin and UCD and Dublin, the first in history law program between North and South in terms of Belfast and Dublin. That brought over American students. We have about 600 at this point graduates of that program who've spent time in Ireland. I co-teach a course in that program having to do with conflict. But between 1995 and 1998, when the peace agreement was signed, I made trips to Ireland along with Professor Haley of Fordham Law School to give talks on conflict and our approaches to dealing with conflicts in the workplace, conflicts in communities. And we were encouraged to do that by the group who came over to our law school as a result of that U.S. Information Agency grant. And so we did our thing as best we could to contribute. I'm very proud of the summer law program that continues to bring students to both Northern Ireland and the South, and those are the kinds of things that I felt important to be involved in, areas that I could assist and participate in myself.
I'd like to bring you back to the year 2000, when a mutual friend of ours, Jim Gill, was chairman of Battery Park City Authority, and indeed through the urging of Governor Pataki of New York at the time, an Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City was very much to the fore, but it was also kind of vague as to, what form this would take, how to go forward. And I was privileged to be in on the ground floor there, but you, as part of the executive board, again, we're very influential in getting what is now the, Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City, which I think many of our listeners will be delighted to know, has just reopened, rebuilt. The foundation had cracked, and so it is rebuilt, and it is something very, very significant and very much a part of our history. And it also brings us back to, one of the hardest hit areas during the famine that Western Seaboard there, and particularly in Mayo, your parents from Foxford and mine in the neighboring parish of Attymass. That had to ring a bell, so to speak. When you were selected to address something that would be a reflection and a true reflection on the devastation of the famine and what that did to Ireland, and how that would forever in a day change the history of Ireland, not just the famine of 1845 to 52, but the aftermath. And indeed, if you could just address that, I would be, I think it's worth hearing.
Thank you. The history of Ireland and its poverty and challenges certainly I became knowledgeable about because when my parents died in 1988 and 1989, it was a devastating period of my life. And I was dean at the time, and I was also chair of the State Commission on Government Integrity in New York. And I had to go away for a week or two that summer of 89, and I saw where my parents were born. I saw the remnants of the famine all over the area where my parents were born. And my first cousins in Ireland took me to see cemeteries and along the mountain. My mother was born in Foxford, and Kilmore, Upper Kilmore, was an area that was heavily hit. And then I heard about my uncles who participated in the War of Independence. One was a senior commander in the Mayo area, James Boyle, my mother's brother. And I became empowered by my heritage at that point more than any other time in my life, and I've carried that right to the present moment. And so when the Hunger Memorial came up, the idea of bringing some expression of it through a home in Ireland was a non-starter with me, a non-starter in the sense that there was no question that with so many Irish in New York, that was something we ought to do. And I followed Jim Gill's leadership, and Jim Gill was leading the troop on that issue. And in fact, the home that my parents grew up in was one of those that were looked at as a possible site for the Irish Hunger Memorial, and what was chosen was absolutely the perfect choice because it was right in the area where the first reports of the famine emanated in Arimar.
I can now admit, of course, that yes, I was on that scouting committee, and the Fearic home place indeed might well have made it, but of course I'm from the neighbouring parish, Etimass, and I figured, geez, I can't come back and say that the famine house came from Foxford when Etimass was the first parish to report death from starvation. But again, that's tongue-in-cheek, but there are a great year, the call for you today to continue what you are doing and in the varied areas. How would you distinguish law and the teaching of law? Has that changed much over the decades? What are the common factors and themes?
I think certainly law students at this time want to be more practice ready. So when they graduate from law school, they have the skills and not only the knowledge and understanding, but the skills to have a strong start. And so courses and the actual handling of legal matters under the supervision of the faculty called the clinical legal education has been a major presence at Fordham Law School. I was proud to be there at the beginning of the revolution in the curriculum of law students actually representing clients, poor people, in different areas of the law, and learning how to do what lawyers do while in law school. So that is a very significant development. I currently teach a course, for example, in the Electoral College system, and I've said to my students on the first day of class, a lot of interest in the course, obviously because of the last election. I said to my students on the first day of the class, one of the expectations I have for you is that when the course is over, that you have the skills educationally to go into a public high school or another high school or even a grammar school or a community college and provide education about how our system of electing a president and vice president works or doesn't work, and its history. And so I think you find in the law school curriculum a lot of courses being taught by full-time faculty and adjunct faculty that deal very much with all the issues around us, from immigration to the environment, you know, whatever the issue. You will certainly find at Fordham Law School, and I'm sure other law schools as well, faculty who are experienced, knowledgeable, providing the students with both the education and through role-playing and other programs at the school, the ability to actually have a running start as soon as you graduate from law school.
John Peric, I have you know, a flashback to a day where in our studios on Madison Avenue, I was minding my own business, and you came in to talk. You were a guest on the program, but when that was over, we had a sit-down, and you spoke about having that we should become involved, and again, you as a leader of a campaign to which has now developed to being a campaign board of the U.S. Friends of Kilmore Abbey in Galway. And you were telling us at the time about the plight of the sisters, the Benedictine sisters, who were living and whose living conditions were, you know, just horrific. And it was difficult even for those of us who came from the west of Ireland to imagine that something which is one of the top tourist attractions in Ireland, in County Galway and Connemara, that Kilmore Abbey, which indeed in its own history had established a distinction, and here were the Benedictine sisters with the holes in the roof and the rain coming through, and actually it was the abbey itself was no longer, you know, the sisters had to move out. They had to move in pairs or more, whatever number were left, into boarding houses and into, you know, into bed and breakfast. You, again, one of your areas of expertise is you definitely know how to collar many of us and say, look, this is what's happening, and you don't let anybody get away with saying, oh, well, you know, please God, things will get better. You took the bull by the horns and you, can I say, roped us all into doing something which was at the time mission impossible, but you did get, and you still lead this committee to restore, you know, and to make the sisters, the Benedictine sisters, to allow them to continue the great work that they have done.
The Kilmore Abbey is really one of the most, you know, I've been involved, you know, in causes, but there's no cause that means more to me than the cause of building the future of Kilmore Abbey. And the sisters are right now hard at work to establish their first monastery. It's a very, very exciting project. I, along with others, already have made a pledge to put my parents' name on a room in the abbey, in the monastery. And they are trying to raise money right now so that that monastery will be opened, that will bring Benedictine sisters from other parts of the world to Ireland to perpetuate the spirituality of the Benedictine sisters in Ireland. It's I'm really at times astonished that at the hard work that a lot of people like yourself and others have to do to try to raise funds for the sisters, because for anybody that like myself who has a heritage that's Irish, what's very important about that heritage for many of us is our faith and our Catholic faith. And the Benedictine sisters are present in Ireland with a commitment to perpetuate in their way, in a beautiful way, the Benedictine way, the Catholic faith. And it's really been a challenge to raise funds. But that monastery is going to happen. And I would just say to anyone that might find this possible, that's a perfect place to memorialize a loved one and to give whatever you can give. And John Melville, who was on your radio show a few years ago, has now died. And I was at his wake, and I said to his family, he was a very humble guy. He came over as an immigrant, I think, in the 1950s, and he was totally devoted to perpetuating in Putnam County and his heritage. And he got a lot of people to make gifts of $10, $100. I think he made a very generous gift. Right now we're at a point where we're trying to close the American part of the campaign. I think we've raised about, say, roughly $250,000. The goal is to raise another $250,000. There's going to be an event on October 5th at the American Irish Historical Society.
Yes.
Where the Sister Magdalena is coming in talk about the campaign and talk about the future of the abbey. A lot's happened. The abbey has been improved because of the past campaigns. Notre Dame has taken an area to bring over students in small groups, and that's a program open to students of many other schools as well. So it's a very exciting time at the abbey. I mean, you see its picture everywhere. What one doesn't realize, the sisters are struggling, so to speak, just to finish off this campaign. And these are wonderful sisters, and there's sisters that will follow them once the monastery is open. They no longer will have to live in separate farmhouses. Mm-hmm. They'll all come together in a new monastery.
And they also, at a time when the sisters, not just the Benedictines, but since their numbers have tremendously decreased, to have Kilmore Abbey as a place to gather many of the Benedictines from around the world is also worthwhile. And might as well let people know that this event, this fundraiser, will take place at the American Irish Historical Society on Thursday, the 5th of October. And, of course, the a great leader and fundraiser is the director, Mary Reed. She is the director of Friends of Kilmore Abbey, and we will give more information on that after our chat here. But that's, again, the guest of honor, by the way, is Anna McGillicuddy, who is the Irish Deputy Consul General. We look forward to meeting you and indeed many of the supporters of Kylemore Abbey. I would like to, John, again congratulate you on not just that distinguished, most distinguished honor of being the medalist, the recipient from, again, the American Bar Association, but for all of the work that you still continue to do, and you're still a full-time professor. Again, we're proud of what you do, and definitely, I'm sure you'll be joining us tomorrow as Mayo again is vying for the Sam Maguire Cup from our home county.
You know where I am on that. I'm getting I've had communications today with my Irish cousin.
Yeah.
And say, I have a sense this is the year for Mayo.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. Thank you, friend. And I am indeed honored to be your friend for so many decades. Thank you for joining us today, John Feerick.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And friends, I think, well, we don't need really need.